Blog Talk Radio.
Of the Rifleman on Appleseed Radio. I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in tonight and listening to the show. And this will be our second show. I'd like to speak tonight a little bit about what the Appleseed program has to offer people, what Appleseed is, what it isn't, and kind of the way that Appleseed looks at the world around us and about our country. The Appleseed program is very simple. To explain it, it's very simple. It's a rifle marksmanship and safety instruction, and it also teaches the history of our country, the Founding Fathers, the American Revolution, and how we came to be the country that we are. That's basically it. That's basically everything that we do. We have shoots going on across the country. I'm amazed at how rapidly the program has grown and at how many people there are becoming involved with the program. It seems like there is a desire for people and a resonance of the Appleseed message in people's hearts and minds when they hear the message of the Appleseed program. You can see it in their eyes. They immediately want to become involved. They want to help. Several years ago, I'm a rancher. I have a ranch. I raise cattle and deal with all that goes on in a day's work of cattle and fences and farming equipment. Several years ago, we had the hurricanes that struck in Louisiana and in Texas. We had the Hurricane Rita and Hurricane Katrina. And Katrina was a real disaster. It caused a great bit of damage. And it was followed soon after by Rita. Now, Rita was not quite as exciting and as damaging as it was thought to be, but people didn't want to take the chance after they had experienced Katrina. So when people were told to leave the city of Houston to escape the coming storm, they did in great numbers. Now, what they should have done is flooded the interior of the state with millions and millions of people searching out safety from the storm. But the highways were blocked. The gas stations ran out of gas. The highways backed up and came to a stop. People couldn't get anywhere. And lucky for them, the Rita turned out to be a fake disaster. Because if it would have been a real one, then I suppose that there would have been a lot of people injured, a lot of damage done, and people stuck on the highways there. And I watched this from my ranch here, which is in the middle of nowhere. And what I saw was a constant stream of vehicles. That's even though we're in the middle of nowhere on a small, unknown farm-to-market road, the cars continued to stream by. And this is even with so many millions of people stuck on the highways. What we actually saw here was nothing because everybody was stopped on the highway. So the continuous stream of cars here was actually nothing compared to what it could have been. And that opened my eyes to what could have happened, how fragile our society is, how fragile the economy is, how fragile our safety is. If the millions and millions of people who had decided to try and escape Houston had actually been able to get out, there's no telling what would have happened. And you always hope that that things go well and that people's intentions are the best, but it somehow seems a lot of times that that's rarely the case. And what I came to understand is that we would be completely on our own here. No law enforcement, no emergency services, nothing. That really opened my eyes to how fragile our society is. It only takes one hurricane to completely destroy the infrastructure of your local or even your state agencies. And I decided that I needed to do something about it. And at the same time, I'd been growing more and more. My anxiety level had been growing higher about why were things going the way they were in our country? Why were things being handled so poorly? And living out in the middle of nowhere, I thought that there was nothing I could do. There was certainly nothing I could do by myself out here in the middle of nowhere. I didn't even live in a city where I could get a big sign and paint, the world's coming to an end and somebody better wake up and do something about it on it, and go around banging on a bell or a drum trying to get attention, passing out flyers that said, wake up, the world's crashing down around your ears. So I really felt at a loss of what to do. So I began to read about our government, about ways to change the government, and things that I could do. And one day that still left me with nowhere to go, because becoming a part of the government, becoming a part of your government, whether it's local, state, federal, county, is not an easy thing to do. It's a very difficult process to go through. And say that you did become a member of the local city council or the county government, how much actual effective change are you going to be able to make? So things were looking pretty dismal, and I ended up one day in town waiting for it to pick up some feed for the cattle, and I had to wait for the feed to come in. And while I was waiting, I was looking around for something to read, and there on the dashboard was an edition of Shotgun News. And I'd already read all through it. At the time, I was making money on the side by buying and selling firearms and related gear. And I'd already read through it, and I said, well, I'll read through it again. And I came to the section that said Fred's M14 stocks, and at the time I wasn't an M14 shooter. All my rifles were much earlier make antiques. So I usually didn't read that section, and right beside it was a full-page column, and I usually didn't read that either. I'd read the first few sentences a few times, and it had things like Wake Up America and Patriots and Founding Fathers and rifle marksmanship. And at the time, that really didn't interest me because, and it was in fine print too, very fine print. And I thought, this guy, there must be something wrong with this guy. He's like, he's yelling at people. And I'd never really seen anything like that before, any kind of someone trying to talk to you about personal things, about duties to your country and stuff like that in a magazine. So I thought, he must just be some type of mentally dislodged person. But sitting there, I thought, well, I don't have anything else to do right now. I'll read this and see what it says. And I started reading it, and the more I read, the more amazed I was that here, this was speaking to me about the exact things that I had been trying to figure out myself. How to help myself, my home, my family, and then beyond that, my community, my city, my state, and my country. And the way to do that was to become involved with others who were like-minded. And that really gave me a charge, because even just reading it, even before I'd even attempted to contact the Revolutionary War Veterans Association, I already felt a type of connection, because I felt that, listen, there are other people out there thinking the same way that I am. There are other people out there that are seeing that there's problems and that something needs to be done about it. But what can we do? How can we do it? How can we get involved? How can we make a difference? And I contacted the Revolutionary War Veterans Association. This particular article had Fred talking about no one in Texas offering any land up, no one in Texas volunteering to become part of the program, offering any land to use for rifle marksmanship. And I called up, spoke to the folks there, and within 24 hours they had an instructor out, looked at the site, approved it, and we were well on the way toward holding an event here. That was several years ago and many, many events ago. There's been a continuous stream of events in Texas at this location. And now they're sprouting out. They're growing. The seeds have been spread from here, and they're growing in different locations around the state now. We have the El Paso, Midland. We'll have one in Navasota, Fort Worth. We're working on one in East Texas and one in Houston. The whole idea of Appleseed is to have the Appleseed program owned and run locally so that the program is owned by the people of the communities who live there, so that you can be connected with your neighbors in your city and the other members of your county, all join together, practicing involvement in rifle marksmanship, safety, and reconnecting with the founding fathers. Everyone has a different role to play in America, and you'll have to seek out what role you play. You can be the person who complains about what's going on in the country. You can be the person that that gnashes their teeth about what's going on in the country and do nothing about it. Or you can be the person who simply doesn't think about it. Just gets on the couch, gets a drink, gets a beer, gets a remote, puts on your favorite comedy show, a show that lasts 30 minutes, and they, even if they were to introduce some drama, the whole situation would be worked out and things would be right at the end of 30 minutes. And then you can switch to the next show where things can be worked out by the end of it. Or you can go to a football game, watch the game, and just ignore that anything's going on. Or you can become involved. At Appleseed, we've simplified the roles that Americans can play, and we've divided them into two categories. We use the Titanic analogy, and we use this analogy quite often in our discussions, and we're casting people for roles in the story every day. The scene we're casting for in our story shows passengers on a beautiful antiquated cruise liner, and after a collision with an iceberg, it appears that the ship is sinking. Water's rising fast. The decks on the ship are rapidly passing under the water. Each deck fills and sinks below. There's a crowd gathered on the uppermost deck, and this crowd, it appears, is split into two categories, split into two groups. The first group, and this group is certainly the largest by far, has people wailing and moaning and shaking their fists in the air and crying and covering their eyes and they're just lost. Some of the people are actually ignoring that anything's going on. They're acting like nothing's actually happening anywhere, and they're just they're laughing and chatting and smiling and talking about superficial events. Some of them are just sitting there glassy-eyed, and they're just muttering to themselves over and over, how did this happen? Oh, what will we do? What will we fix this? Who's going to save us? Well, they're not doing anything. They're just saying that over and over. The second group is starting to form work brigades to handle the evacuation of water from the ship. They're passing out buckets for bailing, and they've set up a bucket line, a bucket brigade, where they're taking buckets of water out of the bilge, sending it up the stairs, and finally pouring it over the side, and then another line sending the buckets back to begin the process again. Another group of the guys in this second group are trying to find out where the location of the damage and what kind of damage they are that has occurred during the collusion. Another group in this second group is gathering supplies that they'll need for making repairs, and others are trying to get medical aid and helping to fix up anyone that was injured in the collision or in the bailing effort while they're working, or even by the stampede of the ship's crew to jump off the ship and get in the life rafts and leave. Some of the folks are searching for and getting food and water to help feed and give drink to the people that are working. Now, in this scenario, the members of the second group, the volunteers for the bucket brigade, before they're allowed to volunteer, we asked them, do you believe we can win this battle with the rising water? And even if you do not, will you continue to bail even as the water reaches your neck, your chin, your nose? If they answered yes, then they were allowed the honor of volunteering to help. It was decided that that none of this group would be whiners. No one would be naysayers or doubters, and no one would be allowed to stand idly by in the ship's decks or hallways doing nothing and waiting for somebody else to do it. Everybody would be working. Now, the first group that we talked about, they would be still up on the deck, bemoaning their fate, still crying and whining and waiting for someone to save them. The second group, the volunteers in the bucket brigade, those guys, they've committed themselves to a course of action in order to save themselves and to save their ship. The first group, they've committed themselves to a course of action which compels them to do anything and everything but help themselves. The first group's requirements also call for them to criticize and rebuke the folks in the second group for having a love of their ship and a common cause which unites them, rather than seeking the satisfaction of their own personal needs and wants and feelings first, which would require them to remain idle until someone satisfied those needs. Now, as I mentioned earlier, no roles are permanent. There's no roles that you're locked into, that you have to accept. A role in the first group of the whiners and the criers, they're idling their time away, listening to the band play on as the ship, which is carrying their wives and children aboard as passengers also, once as it slips beneath the waves, plunging to a watery grave, thousands of feet below the surface. Now, that role can be exchanged for a role in the second group, the bailers, with ease. All you have to do is flip a switch and make a commitment. Now, ships may later be constructed, which can be christened with the same name. Another ship can be made, called the Titanic, but it will never be the same ship. And you might survive the sinking of the Titanic, and someday maybe you'll marry again. Maybe I'll even have children again. But that wife and those children will not replace the wife and children you lost. Now, at the same time, it can go the other way, too, unfortunately. Men and women from the second group, the bailing party, they might become tired. They may become worn out and disenchanted with the constant bailing they're doing, which it never seems to end. It never seems to be doing more than just allowing the ship to sink at a little slower rate, rather than any actual gains being made in the saving of the ship, of getting enough water out that they can get to the holes to fix them, or getting enough water out that the ship starts to rise and reverse the sinking. Because of so few hands doing the job of many, these guys, they begin to feel worn out and abused, and they become disheartened and decide that perhaps it's, you know, hey, maybe it's just as well if the ship just sinks. Or they might feel some real or perceived slight has impugned their honor or injured their feelings and leave the bailing group in a huff because somebody might have said something to them because maybe they weren't bailing fast enough or who knows what. Some people are just like that. And maybe these guys even, they get so angry about somebody telling them maybe they need to bail faster that they decide that they're even going to start laughing as the ship sinks. Or even worse, they're going to drill holes in the ship's hull to help scuttle it. Maybe even puncture or damage the buckets their former buddies are using to bail with. dying. It's better if the whole ship went down than their own personal dignity be wounded by a word here. They're asking to hasten the bailing, lest the ship sink beneath their feet. How can all the misery be worth it? The people that we look for to Appleseed are the people from the second group, the Bucket Brigade. Those are the folks that have left their egos at the door, and when they receive a message, a mission such as we have given them at Appleseed, which it's of such importance that people will continue to bail even as their heads slip beneath the water. These are the kind of men that George Washington was speaking of during the American Revolution when he wrote to Congress about the type of soldiers that he needed. And, you know, he got a bit disheartened with some of the stuff that he saw in the beginning and even throughout the Revolution. There was the whole American Revolution was not a pretty event. There was a lot that went wrong. There was a lot that went right. But there was a lot that went wrong also. I read a book entitled Almost a Miracle just recently. And it went throughout the Revolutionary War, and it followed the course of the American Revolution. And you could see how over and over again, as the title of the book said, it was almost a miracle that we made it through the thing. There were so many dangerous pitfalls. Anyway, Washington was writing to Congress about the types of soldiers he needed to fight the battle, to win the war. And he described them as the type of men who will make a brave defense when success is very doubtful and falling into the enemy's hands is very probable. Now, that says a lot, because what he's saying is, well, we need guys who are going to stand there, who are going to stand in the ranks and continue to defend America against the British, even when success is very doubtful, even when it looks bad, when success is very doubtful and falling into the enemy's hands is very probable. There's no way that you're going to fight a battle. There's no way it's going to turn in your favor at the last minute if you have given up way before the last minute. You still have to be fighting at the last minute for you to receive that type of blessing. A lot of people think that the beginning of the American Revolution was it conquered with the fabled shot heard around the world. But that's not actually the case. Part of the history that we teach at Appleseed is that there were three strikes of the match. Three strikes of the match that had to be struck to actually light the fuse of revolution. The first strike of the match was at Lexington on April 19, 1775. The British had been sent from Boston on a mission to confiscate the cannon and powder and any other articles of war making they could find at the town of Concord. They had left around 10 o'clock at night from Boston, been ferried across the Back Bay and landed at Letchmere Point, and then began their march through the night to Concord. Paul Revere and his Mechanic Society and a great many other named and unnamed players in the game had been working to secure the intelligence of when this was going to happen. The event was not a complete surprise. There had been many other events similar to this. They had had several attempts by the British to confiscate powder from the colonials. They figured that if the colonials had no gunpowder or ball or rifles or cannon, then it must be much easier to control if the population were not armed. So there had been powder raids already before, and because of the powder raids, the people had become outraged. They decided that by what right did the British, the British regulars, did the ruling, the government in Great Britain, these were colonists. They were still British, but they considered themselves, after 200 years, they considered themselves to be colonials. As much or more of their home was America as Great Britain was, but they were still British citizens. And that meant they had rights under the British Constitution, under the British Articles of Law. And by what right did the British sally forth from Boston and confiscate powder and cannon, things that the colonists used for defense of their cities, their towns, and villages? Because they had done this couple of years leading up to 1775, they had reorganized their training bands and their intelligence gathering systems, and they knew the exact date and time when the British were going to be, when the British regulars were going to be leaving Boston. That is where the one if by land, two if by sea signal came in. And people think that this was a signal for Revere. A lot of times they don't, not that familiar with the history, but it wasn't. The one if by land, two if by sea was a signal to people already on the other side of the bay in case Revere was not able to get out of town. General Gage had ordered all exits to the town be closed. And Boston was essentially an island at the time. If you look at pictures now and pictures then, it's unrecognizable because of all the fill-in of the bay. But Boston was basically a bay then. I mean, basically an island then. And the access and egress points from the island were two necks, and they could easily be closed. And Gage had also sent mounted infantry and cavalry into the interior of the countryside that evening also to stop any messengers who might race ahead to give signal that the British regulars were out. Bonrevere made it from Boston. He was rowed across the back bay by the by friends, and he was rowed under the shadows. Luckily, the shadows, the rise of the moon that evening, across the town and across the HMS Somerset, the British man of war stationed there in the bay, actually to prevent any type of movement across the bay, shrouded Revere and his rowers in darkness. That allowed him to row across the bay unseen. He got to shore, mounted a horse that had been loaned to him called Brown Beauty, and headed off to warn the countryside. The British soldiers, the British regulars, were on the march then, at a quick march. They were marching approximately 1 mile every 16 minutes. And as they marched, they began to hear alarm bells in the countryside, and they began to hear signal guns as they were marching. And when I say alarm bells, I'm not talking about like the carillons and the large bells that you hear in church towers and stuff now. I'm talking about just the village bells, you know, the clang, clang, and signal fires on the hills. These were the warnings that the signals that had already been pre-selected by the country people and the villagers to warn each other if the British regulars had sallied forth from Boston. So as far as your road and spread the message. The message was in turn spread by others, just like a modern-day phone tree. You would alert a town, and that town would send off riders. And then when those riders reached their destination and alerted another village or town, those riders would send off theirs. So it was an exponentially growing number of people being alerted, even just by Paul Revere and the folks with him riding that night. Now, the alarms had reached Lexington. The alarm had reached Lexington earlier on the 18th that something might happen. And because of the mounted infantry and cavalry that had been sent out as scouts and actually to later block the roads, the villagers knew that something was about, something was going on. Because the soldiers usually had made their way back to Boston before the night had come on. They would ride out on their scouting missions or survey missions, but as dusk came on and it grew dark, they would have already made their way back to Boston, back to their garrisons. But they stayed out this night, and they even tried to make small talk with some of the locals, and they would begin to ask questions of who was where, and have you seen this person, and Hancock and Adams' names were mentioned. Now, this caused a great deal of alarm, because Adams and Hancock were in Lexington, and there was actually a detail of men sent to guard the house that they were staying at. So they were a bit wary already that something was up and something was going on. Now, when Revere got there, he alerted the house, and they alerted the militia, and this was around 1 o'clock in the morning. And they began their muster, and they were trying to decide what to do. Now, in the New England militia, in a militia, of course, it's much different than a regular army or any type of professional army or group. You have guys that are elected as commanders by the rest of the people in the village. And usually the way they do that is they would elect somebody that they knew who had done a good job because of the office that they held there. Somebody was a good businessman, and they had held several offices of trust in the local village or town. Then they were usually selected as the commander, because how else would you know what somebody could do? If they hadn't held some type of public office in the village, then what did you really know about them? How well could they do their job? Unless they were a prior service in, say, the French and Indian Wars, unless they had already been in the military. Other than that, then they were usually selected as the most knowledgeable men of the town who had held public office. In Lexington, Captain Parker was commander of the militia. And he assembled the men, and the first thing that they did was discuss what was going on, what was actually happening. The British, it had been reported that the British regulars were out, but what were they doing? Where were they going? He sent a few riders out to find out where the the regulars were and what they were doing. And so they sent the riders out. And not long after that, one of the riders returned and he said, listen, this is, it's just, it must have been a false alarm because I didn't find any, there were no regulars out anywhere. And Farkas said, all right, well, we're going to hang loose here until the other riders get back. If they get back and they say false alarm also, then we'll go ahead and disband. We'll dismiss the militia and everybody can go home and go back to sleep or whatever they were doing. So while they're waiting for the other riders to get back, the men just kind of hung out there. Some of the men went to Buffin's Tavern. They had they probably got a late dinner, maybe something to drink, and waited. The British, meanwhile, were continuing on their quick march to Lexington, the 1 mile every 16 minutes march. They were marching very rapidly, and they weren't in that great a mood, I'm sure. There had been quite a bit of dissatisfaction with the soldiers by the colonials. And there was quite a bit of dissatisfaction with the colonials from the British regulars. They considered the colonials to be country folk and bumpkins, and they didn't have a lot of respect for the colonials, and they began to see them and treat them as inferiors. And the colonials had begun to see their British regulars as not as invaders, but in a more tyrannical role. And these two views had begun to meet in a sharp point. Something, somewhere, was bound to happen because of dissatisfaction between the two groups of people. So the British troops continued, the British regulars continued to march toward Lexington. As they got within a half or quarter mile or so of the town, they had managed to cut off one of the riders, and when he rode out to find them, and he got trapped behind them. But as the British regulars came to within approximately a half mile of the town, the rider that Parker had sent out managed to get back around in front of them and galloped into town. And he alerted the militia there, saying, The regulars are out, the regulars are coming, and they're right behind me. So even though the militia in Lexington had hours and hours to get ready, it was almost as if they had no time to get ready, because when the rider came back, the regulars were right behind him. Parker called for the drummer to beat the muster drum to try and get as many of the guys back into formation as he could. Now, as he was doing this, Hancock and Adams' secretary ran and got a hold of Paul Revere and told him that a box of documents had been left there in the upstairs building at the tavern, and that it held all the names and all the dates and the notes from different meetings and discussions on what the colonials and the Continental Congress and the committees of safety, rather, had all decided to do, and that they needed to get it out of the tavern into safety. So Revere raced over there with him, and they were dragging this heavy trunk of papers down the stairs and out across the green. He actually went right through the center of Parker's men who were mustering as the British were coming along, as they were marching toward town. And as the British regulars had left that morning, Colonel Smith, who was in charge of the party, had decided that he was a bit worried. Once he'd heard the alarm bells and the signal fires and things, he began to become a little anxious about their mission. And he decided he wanted to try and move the group faster, at least the first 8 or 10 companies, so that they could secure the north and south bridges in Concord when they arrived. And he selected Major Pitcairn to move ahead quickly with the fastest of the British regulars. So that group moved out, and commanded by Major Pitcairn. And in the lead, Pitcairn had chosen Lieutenant Jesse Adair to lead the first few companies. Adair was a hard charger. He was a professional soldier, and you can't say how exactly bright he was, but he'd get the job done. He'd keep the people moving, and that's what they wanted. So Adair had been put in charge of keeping the guys moving. As they came up to Lexington, the road came to a Y. The right side of the road split off toward Lexington Green, the commons there, and then the road went on to Bedford. Now, the road to the left went on to Concord, where their mission were supposed to lead them. Now, at this critical junction, the lieutenant, Jesse Adair, had to make a decision. When he came up to town and he came up to the intersection, he could see that there was a group of men mustering on the commons, a group of armed men, which probably looked a lot larger than it was. There were probably between 36, 37 men that had mustered, and others were moving in as Adair was riding up, to probably what eventually became 60 or 70 men there. But this left Lieutenant Adair in a quandary. Did he continue on to Concord, as his orders led him to do, leaving an armed body of men on his flank, or did he take the road to the right into Lexington Green and confront the colonials there? Some remember hearing Adair say words to the effect of, "Damn them, we will have them." I'm sure he was a hard charger, and I'm sure he decided that if they wanted a scrape, he was going to facilitate them. So he led the first three companies that were with him. He led them in, led them to on the fork to the right, and led them in. And the first two companies began to move at a quick pace, at a quick march, and eventually a run. Now, the third company behind him was actually stopped halfway to the green. As he led the first two companies in. As this was occurring, Major Pitcairn came riding up and saw that they had turned off to the right, and he grabbed the rest of the guys, the other four companies, and led them on to the left on the road to Concord. Once he'd done that, he spurred his horse toward Lexington Green to try and regain control of the situation. As the first two companies, as they got to Lexington Green, as they entered the green and they began to run almost in a charge, and then they immediately deployed into their combat formation in line. Now, as soon as they did this, they began that the British battle cry, the professional chief's battle cry, supposed to help keep up their courage and to spark fear in the enemy. And that was, like the deep voice, huzzah, and just repeating it over and over, huzzah, huzzah, huzzah. And that was an attempt to strike fear into the enemy and also to bolster their own courage. But when you have a couple of hundred guys yelling huzzah as loud as they can, it's hard to hear yourself think, let alone let anyone else hear what you are doing. Now, Pitcairn spurred his horse on, and I imagine he was trying to get between the two groups, trying to stop what he could see was turning into a bad situation, and started yelling to Parker's men who had assembled on the green. He started yelling at them to lay down your arms and disperse, you damn rebels. And the cry was taken up by a couple of the other officers who also were yelling for them to disperse. By this time, Parker's men, who had seen that they had done what they had set out to do, which was to stand in protest in front of the British, and they had done that. And with these odds, no further protestation was necessary, and the futility of it was rather evident. And at this time, he gave his men the command to disperse. He didn't say lay down your arms or bend your knee. He just said disperse, disperse, which some of the men did. And it was hard to hear because of the loud huzzahing that was going on. It was hard to hear. Some of the men heard, some of them began to speak. Some didn't. So, at this time, the two groups of men were facing each other, and the British were huzzahing, and somewhere, while the colonists were attempting to disperse, somewhere, somehow, someone fired a shot. Now, no one knows where the shot came from. If it came from someone over near the Buckman Tavern, or someone on the other side of a fence, no one knows for sure. So the British and the Colonials are both certain that neither of their sides fired the first shot. Now, some of Captain Parker's men, some of the Colonials, say that that the first shot was fired by one of the mounted officers in the rear. Whether it was a warning shot, designed to try and strike fear into the Colonials and warn them that they could be shot at, or if it was a shot fired by one of the Colonials who was not even involved there, trying to strike fear into the British. Nobody can say for sure exactly where the first shot was fired from, although both sides agree that the first shot wasn't fired by the British men facing them, or by the British regulars facing them, or by the Colonials facing the regulars. But someone fired. Now, the Colonials reported that Major Pitcairn then gave the order to fire. And at first there were a few more shots, and then there was a ragged volley, and then a much larger volley with the sound sounding like a bedsheet ripping as the muskets began to go off in close order, one going off at the same time the next and the next. But the Colonials said they heard Major Pitcairn command to fire. Major Pitcairn was an honorable man, and he said that he did no such thing. He said he commanded his men, he ordered them, soldiers, do not fire, attempt to surround them. Which probably wasn't a good idea, because if you have a group of men, hundreds and hundreds of men yelling and huzzaing, and you say, soldiers, do not fire, then that's probably the part they're going to hear. They're probably going to hear, fire. And so they did. And they fired on the colonials. Two were killed immediately. The British began firing and reloading and firing again without orders. They just began to fire wildly. Anytime you have two groups of untrained men facing each other, that's a recipe for disaster. If they were veterans, if they'd already been through this type of a situation and had already seen this type of event, then it's much less likely that there would be any mistakes, because the veterans have a much clearer idea of what's going to happen and why it should happen and when, and but they weren't. The British regulars were untried, untested troops, and so were the colonials. So when the firing began, they began to fire volleys and repeat without any orders. The British regulars, the officers, attempted to stop the men, but the men would not listen to any orders. They continued to fire. They continued to fire, shoot in all directions, and continued to move about and even bayoneting some of the wounded or shot there in Lexington Green. When the British volley first started, there were several guys coming out of the meeting hall, out of the town meeting hall, and two of the guys were shot as they were coming out, and a third one ran back in, and he was chased by the British regulars. And rather than surrendering to them, he ran up the stairs into the top room where the town's gunpowder was stored. And he took his loaded musket and he stuck the barrel into an open barrel of gunpowder and cocked the hammer back out on it. And he vowed that if they chased him into the room before they came in and they took him, that he would fire into the barrel and destroy the building and any of the soldiers there around. Now, about this time, Colonel Smith came riding in, and he saw that the British troops were not listening to orders, and that they were acting in a wild fashion. Shooting anytime they saw any of the civilians or any of the men anywhere they were shooting at them. And he immediately summoned a drummer, and he got the drummer to muster down arms. Now, the British regulars, they'd been trained to listen to the drums. They had to listen to the drums even in the heat of battle, because drums were used to signal the orders during the battle. So he got the drummer to play down arms and finally got the men to stop their attacks. As he wrote it, he was desirous of putting a stop to all further slaughter of the deluded people. And as soon as he got his men, as soon as he got them assembled, he marched them back out, back onto the road to Concord. And once there, the men were still, the regulars were still a bit angry. I suppose that they were looking for a bigger battle, or they or they were angry that they were being yelled at because they had been firing indiscriminately, and they weren't in the best of moods either. But they had all loaded their muskets, and marching around with a loaded musket wasn't that great of an idea. The muskets were known to, it only took a little bit of a spark to set off the gunpowder, and Colonel Smith gave the orders that the men could give three victory cheers and fire a volley, fire a mass volley, which would do two things. It would help liven the spirits of the soldiers, and it would also empty the 800 loaded muskets. So they did. They gave three cheers and fired off the 800 loaded muskets. For them, it was a victory cheer. They'd bested the others in, you can't call it a battle. They shot a bunch of guys who were running away and dispersing. Now, for the people of Lexington, it was a different story. Here were the people standing in their front yards who had done nothing. They had done nothing. They had simply stood there in protest. They had made no threatening gestures. They had done really nothing at all other than say, we're standing here, and we're standing here armed to show you how upset we are with what's going on. And they'd been fired upon and bayoneted and treated as the enemy. So they saw things a bit differently. Of the folks who had mustered, there were 8 killed and 9 wounded from Lexington that day. Several of the people killed had been killed that morning. There had been 5 father and son teams, 5 father and sons, who had been in the muster in that morning in Lexington. Of those 5 father and sons, 4 of the teams, one, either the father or son, had been killed or wounded. Out of 4 of them, of all the people killed there in Lexington, everybody knew somebody. Somebody was a family member. They had all lost family members there that morning. It was devastating to them. So the 3 huzzas and the victory volley by Colonel Smith's men was thought of a lot differently by the citizens of Lexington. Once the smoke cleared and the wounded and dead were taken care of, the muster was again called. And this time, instead of the 70, there were over 140, 150 men answered the call. And the next time they met the British, there was not going to be any hesitation on their part. There was not going to be any wonder about what they needed to do. They were going to meet the British on their own terms. Now, if this had been it, if this had been the end of the meeting, if the regulars had turned around and left and gone back to Boston, there's a good chance that that this might have been the end of it. That it might have that nothing else might have occurred that. That day, because these things had happened before. I mean, it had you'd had several situations where British regulars had fired on colonials. And eventually it had worked out. There had been trials and protests and discontent and more protest, but it had gotten worked out and life had gone on. But that's not what happened. So the revolution didn't need to start at Lexington. There had been a skirmish there, but had that been it, had that been all there was, then it probably would have ended right there. So Colonel Smith, once he had got his men back together on the road to Concord, he called the officers together for an officer's call. Once he did that, he informed them of what their actual mission was, which was to continue on to Concord, and once it conquered, capture or destroy any weapons of warfare, any materials for warfare that might be stored there. They'd had information sent to them, exact information, what cannon were in what shop, what rifles were in what shop, what building held the gunpowder. So someone in Concord had given them the exact information on where the stuff, where everything was. So Smith told his men, we're headed there. We're going to Concord now, and we're going to capture the cannon, gunpowder, and supplies there. Now his men thought the idea of marching further into what apparently was now a completely hostile countryside, the thought of it appalled them. And they tried to tell Colonel Smith, they said, this is a bad idea. As we were marching into Lexington, you could see it looked like an ant bed that had been disturbed. We saw men running with their rifles toward Concord. There were men on both sides of the valley, and they were actually running as fast as they could to get to Concord. We saw signal fires, and we heard cannon and signal guns, and this is a very bad idea. What we need to do now is turn around and get out of here. But Colonel Smith was a man who went by the book. And he answered them in a way that any soldier can understand. He said, I have my orders. And that effectively put an end to any discussion of it. He was the commander, and he had his orders, and they now had theirs. So with great reluctance, it was decided that they would continue on to Concord. And they did. So that is the first strike of the match that began the American Revolution. The next strike occurred in Concord. Whenever the shots were fired in Lexington, there were several men from Concord who'd been sent down to see what was going on, to find out the same way that Parker had sent guys out. There were several guys who had been sent out to find out what was going on in Lexington or with the regulars who were out. Now, as the first volley by the British was fired, some of the guys from Concord happened to witness it. And as soon as the volley was fired, their horses were startled, and they took off riding back to Concord to get back as quick as they could and deliver the message of what they'd seen. When they got back to Concord, the men reported what they'd seen, and how the British regulars had come into town, formed up in lines of battle, and then fired a volley at the militia that was in formation there on the green. then the question asked of this of the writer was, were they firing ball? Meaning, were they actually firing bullets? Much like you would hear, perhaps from today, if there are protesters out and somebody was firing tear gas or rubber bullets to disperse them, and you started seeing some of them falling down, and you later reported on this, and you say, well, do you think they were actually firing real rounds? And the writer reported, I don't know, but I think they might have been. This put a whole new spin on the situation, because it was not unheard of for the regulars to fire blank-loaded muskets. And that was just a way of saying, hey, we've got these muskets, and we can use them to shoot at you, and it can do some damage. But right now, we're just firing a blank charge just to prove to you that we could be dangerous. So they immediately began a consultation of what to do in the New England militias. There weren't you didn't give it. There weren't a whole lot of orders given. The militias consulted about what they should do, and that's what happened in Concord. You had three groups here. You had the Minutemen, which were the younger men, the men who were counted on to have their gear together quickly and be able to take off in a quick fashion from their homes. Most of the guys were unmarried, in good physical shape, and young. Then you had the middle-aged men who were in the militia. And a lot of these guys, a lot of them had combat experience and held different offices, and they were the older men, the 20 to 40 year old men. And then you had the gentlemen from the mid 40s to the 60s who were on the alarm list, and each of them had different missions, and they each had different ideas about how to follow through with the situation. The men consulted together, and the young men of Concord were in favor of going out on the road and meeting the regulars as they approached town. The middle-aged men were in favor of making a stand in town. And the older, even more experienced men were in favor of moving out of town until more reinforcements had arrived. So in the fashion, in the New England, typically New England fashion, they decided, well, we'll do all three. How about that? And everybody can be happy. So the young men gathered together, and they began their march out of town. And when they'd gotten approximately a couple of miles from town, they saw the British column approaching with their grand music playing, the drummers playing, and all of the men in matching uniforms with rifles and bayonets mounted. And when you think about muskets and flintlocks today, you think about what you see in museums or in movies, and they have these rusty brown colored patina artifacts, and that's in your mind, that's how you see them, but that's not the reality of it then they were bright and shiny, and they reflected the rising sun that morning, and I'm sure it looked like a red centipede headed toward them with thousands of shiny porcupine quills on it. And the men formed up, the colonials formed up, the Minutemen formed up into a line of battle. And as the British regulars marched toward them, the front of the formation began to open out into a line of battle. The column didn't have to stop. They had already practiced these types of things. As they're marching, the front of the formation starts opening up into a line of battle. Now, seeing professional soldiers on maneuvers and performing complex maneuvers is not something that helps your courage, because what it tells you is that you're facing a professional group of men, a professional group of armed men who are trained in the art of warfare. As they saw these hundreds and hundreds of men approaching their position, and they saw the front of the column opening up like some type of a dragon's jaws, the Minutemen began to reconsider their decision. And when they did, they decided that the older men probably knew what they were talking about. With their experience, they probably knew what they were talking about. And why don't we go back and do what they decided we should do, which is let's wait in town. Now, I'm not saying they ran because they didn't. They got themselves back into an orderly column, and they began marching back into Concord. And they had their own drums and fife music, too. And they began marching in a nice, formal way, the colonials did, with their drums and fifes playing. And they even had the fifers playing the White Cockade. And the White Cockade was supposed to be a galling, a bitter song, an old Jacobite song that was supposed to cause some type of anxiety to the Hanoverians there, to the British regulars. I'm sure it could probably be compared to playing Dixie for the Federal soldiers, maybe by the Confederates or something like that, after the war was over. Nevertheless, they began their march back into town. Now, as they did, the British forces that had begun to deploy came back into formation, and they were marching once again in a regular column formation right behind the colonial militiamen, the Minutemen, into town. So it was kind of like just one long extended parade. When the Minutemen got back into town, they consulted with the rest of the militia and alarm list men there. And some of the people were still of the mind that they wanted to, if they were going to fight, let them fight right then and there in front of their homes. If they're going to fight a war, let it be here. If we're going to die, let us die here today in front of our homes. And another man brought up the fact that no, it won't do for us to begin the war. And he was right. It would not do. It would not look right for them to begin the war. And they all thought about it some more, and they decided, you know, the older guys in the alarmists, they had a pretty good idea. They had a pretty good idea. Let's get out of town here for a while, and then we'll regroup over on Punctacet Hill, which was about a mile from the center of Concord, and we'll wait for reinforcements. Because you have to remember, at this time, reinforcements had been constantly streaming in from all over the country. By the end of the day, over 11,000 men under arms were in that section of the country there. Altogether, it's believed that almost 22,000 men under arms would eventually assemble. And this is in a time of no internet, no telephones, no TV, no radio, and they still manage to get up thousands and thousands of armed men to help defend the country. So men were streaming in all the time, and they figured if we can get over to Punctacet Hill and regroup, then perhaps, and we don't cause a face-to-face with the British regulars, then perhaps we'll have time to get enough men that we can still have our protest in front of them, and they will have to take us more seriously because we'll have more men. So that's what they did. They moved their group over to Punctacet Hill, and when the British regulars arrived in Concord, there were no men of probably below the age of 65 or 70 there. They began their search immediately, and they began, and it's described this way, they began breaking into houses and searching houses without warrant. And that's pretty important. And that's one of the reasons that you find that listed in our Constitution is of no unreasonable search and seizures. That you have to have a piece of paper saying what it is you're searching for and where and why. Because of that exact thing. You can't live in a country where somebody can just come and look and do anything they want for any reason. And that's what they were doing there. Now, they weren't finding anything because the town had had weeks to prepare for this. They'd heard the news that something was afoot, and they had already moved everything of any value to the surrounding towns. Even at Colonel Barrett's. Now, as soon as the regulars got into Concord, a detachment of seven companies was sent out to the North Bridge to secure it, and then four of those companies were detached and sent out to Colonel Barrett's to search his home for articles of war, which had been reported there. Another company was sent to the South Bridge to secure it. It was thought that the South Bridge would need the least amount of defending. So those men were sent out, and they searched Barrett's farm. Now, Barrett, of course, had prior word, along with the rest of the town, and all of the arms and munitions had been moved. Now, there were some rifles there, but that they thought might be needed, but those rifles, in the day before, had been laid into trenches that had been plowed up. They'd been laid in the trenches, and the trenches had been plowed back the other way and had covered them up. It was planting time of the year, so nobody, there was nothing suspicious about it. Nothing was found there at Barrett's farm. At the same time, the troops searching Concord really hadn't found much of anything either. They'd found a large amount of spoons, and they'd found what is listed as trenchers. And trenchers could be one of two things. Trenchers could be either just a plank of wood that had a depression in it that you could eat off, kind of like a wooden plate. You had a depression in it so that the gravy and so the stew didn't run off. Or it could be actual things made, wooden tools that were made for digging trenches. You had to have trenches to... that was what you used to dig trenches to take runoff water out of the towns and to cut irrigation paths for your fields. And there was a large number of trenchers supposedly found too, more than they thought that the town needed. These were piled into the town, and then also the town's Liberty Pole was cut down. And as I said, the people's homes were searched. They found 24-pound cannon by bursting into the innkeeper's inn, knocking on the door, and Pitcairn placing a pistol against his head and saying, listen, you're going to tell me where the stuff is or I'm going to blow your head off. And he did. And they busted the trunnions off the iron guns, and they took the gun carriages and piled them up with the rest of the stuff, and they burned it. And as they did, the smoke rising could be seen by the men on Punctacet Hill. And when they saw the smoke rising, that was another different story for them too, because if your house burned down in 1775, you couldn't call a contractor and have them get you another one. You couldn't apply for a FEMA trailer. You were out of luck. You had to have a house, and it had to be ready, and it had to take you through the winter, It had all your food in it, all your clothes. Everything was in there. If the town burned down, people would be ruined. Their lives would be ruined and changed. As they saw the smoke rising, several of the men began to protest. One of the lieutenant, the adjutant that they had with them, actually stepped forward and told Colonel Barrett, "Will you let them burn the town down now?" As he did that, several of the other other captains strode forward and said that they were ready to assist in it. Isaac Davis drew his sword and said, "I have not a man who is afraid to go." And that pretty much clinched the deal. They had the town that appeared to be burning. They appeared to be setting a fire in the town, in their town, that had done nothing wrong. So they began moving the men down from Punctafton Hill down toward the North Bridge. Now, a company of troops had gone across the North Bridge and occupied the high ground just on the other side from the town. As they saw the men coming down the hill toward them, they began to give way and move back across the bridge. They were a little bit excited about this, about the colonial troops moving in formation, moving like regular troops. They had thought that these guys were going to run at the first sight of the British regulars, or that they were going to be just a screaming mob of pitchfork-wielding peasants and country folks, and it appeared that wasn't the case. It appeared they were moving down upon the British in what one regular soldier described as a very regular manner. And you could almost hear the shock in his voice when he wrote that, because they weren't expecting this, and they said that they had never dreamed that the colonials would move against them under arms. And yet here they were. Here they were, moving down the hill in a most military fashion. The company of regulars withdrew back across the bridge to meet up with the other two companies there. And they were ordered then to begin to form into a street firing formation. This is one of the typically archaic and complex formations that the British use. In this formation, you have the front rank kneeling, and then you have the second rank taking a step to the left and the third rank taking a step to the right, and they kept their feet locked with the front rank. Now, this allowed the front rank to be fired over the top of their heads by the second and third ranks, who split so that they could fire in between each other. So say you had 8 men in a rank, that would give you the opportunity to fire a volley of 24 rounds, and as soon as they fired, these men would step, they would split to each side and go to the back and reload and begin again. Now, I believe I'm coming up on the end of the show now, at the most dramatic part. So you'll have to tune in to the show again on this next Wednesday night to hear what happened during the second strike match, what happened in Concord, and why the American Revolution didn't start in Concord like you thought it would. A lot of things did happen in just the next few minutes. A lot of events that would change the outcome of the day's fighting. So I suppose you'll have to tune in again this next Wednesday to hear the rest. I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in and listening to the first two strikes of the match. It's a very important part of what we teach at Appleseed. We can't teach you about the whole American Revolution. We can't teach you about every bit of history that has occurred that helped bring this country about. But we can give you a place to start, and we do that by telling you the three strikes of the match story. Once again, thanks everyone for tuning in. Thanks everybody for listening. And I hope that you'll come back on Wednesday to hear the rest of it. We'll be right back.